Hello, and thank you for tuning into this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. Welcome back if you are a regular listener. How have you been? You're looking good. Don't get too comfy because we're going to be experimenting this year with different formats to see what works best. We've got some really interesting stuff coming your way. And if this is your first time listening, welcome. If you got here via recommendation, I'm sure it will live up to the hype. If there's anything you need to share, get in touch. mark.ward@securityforum.org is the address for any comments, ideas, or requests to join in. This episode is about threats, old and new, the cyber ones, and whether the security industry tackling those threats is going about things the wrong way. And we have a stellar panel of people to explore that problem, each one so well-versed in security that viruses literally bounce off them. My name is Mark Ward. I do research at the ISF, and I've been writing about some security and viruses, things like that, for a long, long time. Not quite long enough to remember the Morris worm. I think I was 88, but the oldest threat virus I can remember is the Michelangelo virus, due to strike on March 6, 1992, and was a resounding flop from a journalistic point of view. Nowhere near enough damage done for my liking. But our first guest is Paul Ducklin, formerly of Sophos and Nikkei Security, and someone else who has been involved with security for a while. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Mark, and everyone else.
Great to have you here. What was the first security thing you remember? Was it a virus, a worm, a breach?
I'll go for three things because they're a great reminder about how we absolutely have to remember history. And they're 1987, 1988, 1989, and it could have happened yesterday. The Christmas tree exec worm on IBM that brought IBM's network down, first mass mailing worm. As you mentioned, the Morris worm, 1988, paralyzed the internet, fledgling internet. And the AIDS information Trojan, the world's first ransomware, 1989. Well, as though we had learned nothing in the intervening years.
Yeah, fun fact. I think wasn't the guy behind the Morris worm, wasn't it? Didn't his dad work for the NSA? Bit embarrassing.
Might have. Robert Morris, and his dad was Robert Morris. Yes, that was very, very embarrassing. Yeah. He was also the first person, I believe, prosecuted under the new Computer Fraud Act in the United States.
Wow.
So he was actually held to account for it right in those early days. I think he got a $10,000 fine. Then that's $1988.
Quite a lot of cash.
And 400 hours of community service. Right. So it was more than a rap on the knuckles, given that, you know, it was the very first time this had been done.
I wonder if his dad put in a word from him. Who knows? Also here is Alice Violet, also formerly of Sophos and Nikkei Security. Hey, Alice.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you here. Any security horror stories, viruses you've been caught out
by? Well, I was just thinking, actually, obviously we talked a little bit just before we started recording about I was kind of the age where when music was suddenly, you were able to download it for free rather than pay per track, which came with all sorts of fun stuff. Mm. But also I remember being the age group where webcam was kind of just emerging. Ooh. And it was like lots of people would get recorded on their webcams and all sorts of things were happening. Yeah, which wasn't good. It was sort of the beginning of that. And thank God we're in an era where hopefully young people are now aware of that because webcams are everywhere. But I remember,
I suspect they aren't.
Oh, do you think so?
Yeah, I'm sure.
But that's a huge thing, Alice. That's all coming back, right? With youngsters being sextorted, basically.
Yeah, right.
That whole sextortion thing is still a big deal. And although it might not affect many people, it's extremely traumatic for those who get hit.
Yeah, definitely.
So, once again, it's like we haven't the sins of the past are coming back to haunt us today.
Yeah, nothing new. Also here is Lee Munton, an ISF analyst, and also formerly of Sophos.
Hi, Mark. How you doing?
Hey, Lee. I'm good. Good to have you here. What's your earliest security memory?
We were discussing this offline just before we started the podcast. I can't remember the name. It may have been ambulance because it certainly had a white ambulance going from left to right on a black screen. And I think it may have deleted some files as well.
All right. And did you get hit by that or solve it for someone?
I solved it for someone else, actually.
All right. Cool.
That's what sparked my interest in security.
No way. All right.
Yeah.
Did they pay you a huge amount of money for that or was it?
No, it was my mum.
Pro bono. No way. Excellent. What had she been doing to contract that virus?
I didn't ask and I don't really know.
Excellent. Good to have you all here. It's going to be a great discussion, I'm sure. Paul, I don't know if you want to kick off by just sending out sort of the, because we circulated sort of ideas prior to the podcast, but just your sort of contention that it's a bit of a numbers game out there, but that's possibly driving the industry the wrong way. Yeah, I'm sure you can explain it much more eloquently than that.
I think that this has always been a bit of a problem that the cybersecurity industry has allowed itself to be drawn into. Now, perhaps I shouldn't single out the cybersecurity industry. You know, if you look at the automotive industry, you know, you go to a car showroom, or you used to in the days before electric cars. I haven't owned a car for a decade or more, right, so I don't really know. But, you know, and they all had, certainly when I was living in Australia, it was a regulation. They had to have a sticker in the windscreen on the showroom floor, and it would have in big numbers. It would have this car consumes, and it would say, you know, 6.8 litres per 100 kilometres.
Right.
And the one next to it would say 6.9. So obviously the one that uses 1/10 of a litre per 100 k's less is way better. And the idea is they're trying to boil everything down to a number. And the cybersecurity industry has been rather bad at doing that, in my opinion, as well. In the early days, we had the sort of number games with how many viruses does your product detect? My product detects 4,800 million, three, you know, and the numbers, they would be accurate to one. Like,
that's true.
And you think,
they were never round numbers, were they?
And the problem was not only that everyone counted differently, so the numbers could not actually usefully be compared. It was as though a product that could get by knowing about a smaller number of malware samples that yet do a good job would inevitably come off as looking worse than a product that needed updating every 5 minutes because it had no proactivity and no sort of future-proofness. So it's almost as though we're fascinated by this number that had to grow, but it was also a number that, if you think about it, kind of marked down products that were probably better. And so, yes, I think we do have that problem of trying to distill everything to some single dimensionless variable that tells you what a product can do.
Yeah, it's like all those estimates of how much damage computer viruses and things cause, because I was always very skeptical of those. It's just like, really? How can you tell? I mean, it's very hand-waving, and like, so all those figures were different, and they didn't share those basic stuff. I don't know, Alice, are you ever, you were just curious about your views on this, sort of whether you have that jaundiced view, or whether you trust any of those numbers that come out of these kinds of those companies?
I kind of agree with Duck. And I think I obviously come from a marketing perspective. And one of the things that I find is about kind of tech companies hoovering up huge amounts of data. And it's a similar conversation. I think, you know, huge big brands like Google and Facebook, we've talked about before on the show, do use that data to actually, you know, drive things. Whereas I think a lot of smaller companies who don't have the same resource feel like they need to be collecting all this data to compete because they hear of huge brands doing it and they're not actually using it or securing it properly. And I think it's a quality over quantity thing. You know, as Duck says, you know, we use all these numbers sometimes without actually thinking about what the point of it is. And I think in marketing, in terms of data privacy, I certainly see that.
Yeah, but I wonder if it's sort of a useful shorthand because people need something to judge these things by, or is it just completely inaccurate and actually the number of viruses out there has no relation to the ones that are actually going to cause the damage?
Well, to comment on Alice's point about hoovering up data, I think we've got this problem even worse with, you know, like the virus, the how many viruses are there number game. We've got that with telemetry. Is a product that collects more telemetry, a cybersecurity product that sucks up more stuff about every process, about every file you access, about everything you do, about every command line parameter, about every email you send, about every website you visit. Is that product of necessity better than one that actually makes do with making its decisions based on collecting very little data? And the argument seems to be that if you don't collect enough telemetry, then you can't compete. And we saw that in a Microsoft press release. I mean, they got breached, didn't they, recently? And shortly afterwards, they had a thing about how much telemetry they collect and how great their data is. And they had some number, I forget what the unit was, whether it was per month or per year or per decade, but the number was 65 trillion. It just stuck in my mind.
That's a lot.
Trillion as in million, million, 10 to the power 12. Data items that they collect every unit of time. You think, why is that of necessity better than a product that can do the same or perhaps even a better job that collects almost nothing at all about what I've been doing online?
I wonder whether, you know, the conversation is changing because more people are aware of sustainability, and especially in the tech space. I think something like 4% of carbon emissions are from digital data, whereas 2% are from the aviation and travel industry. So it's double. And whereas the travel industry is reducing, digital infrastructure is increasing rapidly. And we need to consider that when cybersecurity companies are saying we collect all this data, as you say, Dirk, because then we've got all of this to be looking at. If there is no point to it, you're actually causing unnecessary damage, not just from a data protection perspective, but also from a sustainability perspective.
Amen, sister. That's perfectly true, right? That data doesn't save itself.
No, that's very true. Yeah. Lee, are you a jaundiced old cynic like the rest of us?
Yes, I think I probably am.
Excellent.
I totally agree with the quality over quantity argument. And to add to that, I also wonder, especially if we go back to the AV example, saying you can detect ever-increasing numbers, what does that do to market perception in an industry where fear, uncertainty and doubt has been such a big deal for so long?
Yeah, it just makes people more scared, doesn't it? But I wonder if, you know, there must be something at the bottom of those claims for big numbers, because there must be some viruses that are doing problems, so we're doing damage and catching people out. But is it a case of, well, there's the top 10 that do 90% of the damage? I don't know. I mean, you experts, when you were investigating breaches or writing up about viruses and things like that, was it always the same things that call people out?
They're obviously, it's obviously handy to have the top 10X. Like, you know, there's the top 10 OWASP vulnerabilities. Like, if you really haven't done things on your web server, whether it's in the cloud or in a cupboard under the stairs, those are the things you should look for. What worries me about everyone trying to distill out what they think is the clear and present danger is that it can end up making people take a blinkered view. And I think we saw that in spades with ransomware in the last few years, where companies were so fixated on doing their marketing on the basis of pitching the ransomware problem that they started offering solutions that were tailored to ransomware, specific to ransomware. And it's as though we forgot all the other things that might happen to you, including the very precursors to very many ransomware attacks, which is some other malware that you had for several months that logged all your keystrokes or snooped on your banking screens and all of that stuff until the crooks had milked that for all they got, and then they sold it on to the next lot. So what worries me about top 10 things, although it's good to manage risk that way, is it's almost like these breach reports that say, oh, wow, there was a recent story, 26 billion records in this breach. Now, that includes records that we've counted before and counted before and counted before. So the number is kind of meaningless. And it's almost as though we're demeaning people who've not suffered as seriously as the rest of us. You're like, oh, you had a ransomware attack, it only cost you £2,000. Well, you know, you should just sit and lick your wounds all by yourself. And I think that's the problem, is it's right. sort of, by making the big things sound really big and the top 10 things sound like, wow, this is absolutely terrible, look what it's doing to our economy. Hmm. It's almost as though we're deeming everything else that happens perhaps to the little guys as if it were uninteresting and inconsequential. And I think that's a real problem, because every little thing matters.
Also on that, I think it diminishes the actual perception of those things, because if you were involved in that breach and you can see that it's like had £1 billion taken, or it's, and actually you're thinking, well, it was really minor for us, it almost is a bit scaremongery without the payoff. It's sort of like focusing on the numbers when the people who were impacted didn't see that much impact. And then it makes people think, well, actually, it wasn't that big a deal. And we already see that people ignore cybersecurity because it's either scaremongery or complex. And all of this feeds into that, because it's like, well, there was a huge scary campaign around it in all the newspapers, but actually in reality we didn't understand it or really feel that much impact personally. So we should focus on the person who lost £2,000 and was a small business, for example, because people can see that and relate to that more humanly.
Yeah, but I think, haven't we all been hit by scams, cyber scams? I know I have. I mean, they haven't got away with any money, but I've had to rescue my Amazon account and a couple other things as well. I don't know, Lee, have you been? I mean, I don't think there's any mark of shame to be scammed. It's kind of modern life, isn't it?
Actually, no, I haven't.
No. Oh, see, I told you the virus has just bounced off.
Mark, I think Alice touched on something that you perhaps inadvertently alluded to earlier, just showing this problem about, you know, those who cannot remember history are condemned to repeat it. You reminisced about Michelangelo, which was indeed a huge problem in 1992, as you said, because it kind of wasn't a problem. It was talked up by the cybersecurity media drivers as something that was going to affect millions of people, and it was going to cost tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, a huge amount, inconceivable amount then, and it flopped. And I think exactly what Alice said then happened. People went, "Ah, oh, this is all overblown. I just don't need to worry." Like, I had the Michelangelo virus and I removed it, and I even was there on March the 6th and nothing happened to me. So basically, every report I read in future, I'll divide by a million.
Right. I think it was John McAfee said it'll be the upward bound could be 5 million. And clearly every headline was 5 million computers, which was a lot back then. There's probably quite a few more now. But yeah, I mean, as a former journalist, I'm sure we were, I would like to think I worked for some fairly responsible publications, but not all of them. I think there was quite a bit of hype there.
But is that the journalist's fault in that case, or is it the fault of the fact that they've been fed duff information?
Bit of both,
I think. If an expert says this is what could happen.
Yeah, there's a bit of collaboration. Because you've got to get the headlines. Every journalist wants their story to be the front of the paper.
Yeah.
It was definitely, if you can find it up a bit, as a phrase goes, then why wouldn't you? Yeah, make it land.
But I think Alice is dead right in saying that when things get overblown, it makes people who have suffered what feel like comparatively minor things either go, "Oh well, I shouldn't complain, I had it easy," or go, "Hey, I was on that breach list and I didn't get scammed, so this whole cybersecurity thing is a hoax."
I think from my perspective, when we worked at Naked Security, and that was my first job in cybersecurity, I didn't know anything about it before that. We used to talk about haveibeenpwned.com and websites like that, where you could put in your email address and see whether it had been involved in any data breaches. Now I have an email address I've had for about 2,000 years, and I put it in, and of course it had been breached. Whereas prior to knowing that platform existed, I would have never known that I'd been breached. So I think it's kind of an education thing, you know. And when you say, is it kind of embarrassing to have been breached? I don't think it is, because I've had conversations with people. Like, there's a guy called James Linton who used to be a hacker, and he sent phishing emails to the White House and also like Harvey Weinstein and people. And they fell for it. And he was demonstrating that even people who work in the most secure agency in the United States are falling for a really basic phishing email. So it shouldn't be a mark of shame, I don't think, to say, "Yeah, I've had a virus. Yeah, I've, you know."
But equally, I wonder if there's any parallels with physical crime, because I've almost been mugged and had my house burgled and all kinds of things like that. So. But is that just not modern life? No, Lee, have you?
If we're talking about physical crime, I have been subject to that. I have.
Oh no, I'm sorry.
I had the newest car I've ever owned taken off my driveway.
Yikes!
Yeah, and one of my sons was mugged as well.
Oh my god! But I wonder if do we see cybercrime in different ways? I don't know, because presumably you got some help with that in all kinds of ways, in good ways that would.
Well, now we're getting onto my cynical views of Britain. You know, when my car was stolen, I called the police and they just responded with, "Your crime number is..."
All right.
Okay. And then my son was mugged and no one came out. So, not sure the incident response is very good there.
Maybe there isn't many parallels there.
I think there are, actually. I think there are huge parallels. So one of the topics for that is social engineering. So things like romance scams, where people used to have to manually put in effort to kind of stalk somebody, go through their bin and pretend to be the love of their life. That's now on a huge scale. So with the pig butchering scam that Duck and I chatted about before, just between us, you know, that's basically people going on dating websites, going on Facebook, finding vulnerable people and targeting them en masse, and they work in shifts and things like that. And actually, name drop my own podcast, Cybermaking. We're doing a deep dive into romance scams. And one of the things about it is the parallels between this used to be an offline scam and it's just moved digitally. And actually, I think a huge amount of cybersecurity scams are exactly that. They're just a new digital way of doing something we've always done.
That the problem is it reaches so many more people so effectively that it is a bit different, I guess, from car crime. It will be quite difficult for one gang of car thieves to steal every single car in the entire United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland overnight. Yet, when you look at scams like OneCoin in Europe and Africa, and you look at things like, was it Hypercoin in Australia, very similar thing, basically made up cryptocurrency. They took people literally for billions, thousands of millions of US dollars, just using tried and tested, if you like, multi-level marketing, selling stuff, the same thing that has sold cosmetics and Tupperware for years and years and years, getting people to go and persuade their friends and family to put money into nothing. So the problem is that the scale of it is, as Alice says, is just so much huger. And it can be this small group of people. I believe in a lot of these, the modern take on romance scamming and cryptocurrency scamming, they basically hire a luxury villa in Southeast Asia somewhere, in a country that's relatively inexpensive, bring in all their scammers. And they basically, it's like a boiler room scam, but they're living in a little private secure enclave in the lap of luxury, scamming people on the other side of the world day in, day out.
Yeah, there's one story I didn't do because it was too salacious when I worked at the BBC, which was about fake webcam girls. And it was a romance scam. Young, unscrupulous men usually would steal a load of video of a webcam girl and then pretend to be that girl and then just look for sugar daddies. And it was just it was really grim and nasty because it was preying on all kinds of terrible things. But yeah, I suppose the scale is the big difference. Yeah, stealing all the cars. It's be tricky.
I think there's another problem in the difference between cybercrime and real world crime, and that is, let's say, like you said, Mark, you nearly got mugged. Presumably, you kind of managed to get away, or
I talked my way out of it, actually.
Okay. But the point is that it nearly happened to you. And even if it had happened to you, and say, thinking back in the old days, if you hadn't had your mobile phone on you, if the guy had run off with, 50 quid out of your pocket, you would quite literally be 50 quid out of pocket. But aside from maybe making you fearful and worried to go out and all that sort of stuff, it wouldn't, that lost £50 wouldn't affect your lifestyle potentially for years ahead. When you get breached in a cyber scam, even if nothing happens to you now, even if you think you've got away with it, even if you think, oh, I avoided the digital mugging, that data is going to go into a giant bucket somewhere, because the cyber crooks love their telemetry just as much as the cyber security companies do. That data could come back to haunt you any time in the future for years, particularly if it's something like a scan of your driving license that you were required to provide to identify yourself to an online service, or a passport scam or something like that. So I think that's another problem, is that the car that gets stolen from your driveway today could actually come back to haunt you in cybercrime terms in 5 or even 10 years' time.
Yeah, I mean, it's the bad guys could bring it back, but also it'll mess up your ordinary life as well. There's all kinds of ways that you have to unpick that and sort of get all kinds of reassurances. Well, try and put those in place. So, when people say, oh, wasn't that stolen? Then you have to go, oh, no, actually, it's all recovered. Because I was a friend of my brother-in-law. Yeah, he's got one of his email accounts was almost taken over with a SIM swap. And he had to really fight very hard over 2 or 3 days to get that back. And then had to go to somewhere and convince people, say, no, this is me. I have this account. How could I possibly? And it was not easy for him at all.
Well, with this romance scam stuff that I'm doing, what I'm finding is there's actually victims from all sides, because as you mentioned with the webcam models who have their content stolen, it's one of the things we're learning is the types of people they pretend to be are quite often military or men who work on oil rigs, because they've got an excuse as to why they're not in the country. They can't have phone calls due to security. And these are generally people who genuinely do work on an oil rig or are genuinely, hot military people. So they're also victims, and, they're suffering identity theft. And rather than just doing that once, they're doing this millions and millions of times to blanket reach people online. Sometimes these people are married, or, you might be a woman who's had your picture stolen or used in a different capacity to what you intended them for. And so this has more victims than just the person they're scamming.
Yeah, and presumably it's about to get automated because, all the generative
AI stuff
is really good at being fake people. There's a lot of that going to go on, I'm sure, because there's something I was reading about just now, which was in China, AI boyfriends because obviously that's going to cause all kinds of, if that takes off in any significant numbers, fertility rates and all that kind of
thing. Well, that worries me in terms of data collection and manipulation and blackmail, because I think, imagine if you logged into this fake boyfriend, for example. This makes me think of the face app thing from a few years ago, where they were asking people to upload a picture of their face, what you look like, with pink hair, blue hair. And in the terms and conditions, it said, you know, you're giving face app irrevocable rights to use it infinitely and all third parties, blah, blah, blah. And it makes me think of what on earth they're going to do with that data you're uploading to an AI bot that you fancy. How embarrassing when that you read the terms and conditions and it says we're going to use this publicly for the rest of your life.
We're going to use this to merge your personality with three other people and create yet more.
And also,
I've lost the cybersecurity plot here, because my mind is boggling at the at the concept of AI boyfriend. It is
scary. I don't, Lee, are your kids good with security as well?
Yes. Going back to your previous point, first though, there was a story. I think it may well have been on the Beeb last week, about how someone was using a voice assistant with AI to have a voice assistant they could have general conversations with.
All right.
It wouldn't just be a question and answer session with a voice assistant. It would be full-blown conversations for hours at a time. And I just wonder how much information is being gathered there.
Yeah, well, exactly. This AI boyfriend, yeah, I think you're right, Alice. There's some creepy aspects to it, because it's a confidant and there's all kinds of medical information that's shared, and just, you know, in a relationship, sure, there's a lot of secrets get shared. And I think that's what, presumably, if you're any kind of scammer, that's absolute gold dust.
Totally. If you could hack that data and then say, you know, I'm going to publish this on LinkedIn unless you send me money, you know, that's quite dangerous data.
Yeah, hugely. Yeah.
Same with online therapy, if you know, BetterHelp and things, you know, they need to think about how secure that data is, definitely.
Yeah, so I wonder if it's not numbers, then is it people? Is that what we need to do? We educate people? Is that going to be the main way through it? Lee, you're nodding there.
Yeah, always. You know, having been involved in security training and awareness, it is a fundamental part of this. Technology can always help. Technology can often do the heavy lifting. But at the end of the day, it's always people behind it.
But it's presumably, it's not a question of you'll never get caught out, because people do. But it's a question of knowing what to do if you are. Because I suppose that'll be quite rare.
Well, I think maybe there's another step before that. You know, will we all get caught out at some point? Probably. Can we help ourselves by making sure we're not the low-hanging fruit? Definitely.
Okay. Yeah. It's like running away from bears, isn't it? Always be the faster one.
Yeah.
It is very much a case that nothing is as good as being prepared. You know, practice is something that you cannot do live. And whether you're thinking of this as an individual or as a sysadmin or as a CISO, this is really important. And I think a lot of companies get caught out if they suffer a breach, because they simply haven't done a dry run of how they need to react technologically. Their sysadmins might be great at going in and fixing things. They might run their own SOC. They might have a great managed security provider who can come in and fix things for them. But there are all the ancillary things that they never think to practice. Like, who do I have to tell? Which regulator needs to know about this? What am I going to say? How am I going to communicate with my customers? Am I going to start my email by saying, your security is important to us, by way of admitting to your customers that what you really mean is you had no care at all about it until moments ago?
We take your security very seriously.
Yeah. Now, so practice does make perfect, and it is time well worth spent. And, you know, as an individual, you think, well, if I get breached, you know, I won't need to tell the Information Commissioner's office. I won't need to deal with the media. But if you need to recover, say, your Facebook account or your LinkedIn account or whatever, have you gone through the site to find out what you will need? Have you done a dry run for yourself to decide how you might recover things? If you realize there's fraud on your payment card, for example, do you know the number that you need to call from the bank, you know, because your wallet might have been stolen, so it's not, you don't have it on the back of the card. So you need to do this preparation, because the scammers are great at what you might call counter scams or follow-up scams. When they realize you've rumbled them, they will steam back in and say, hey, I'm, you know, I'm Chief Inspector so-and-so of the XYZ Police Force, and we've had a report of, and they'll just play a completely different game, and they'll pretend to be on your side and milk you for yet more information if you're not careful. Or they'll say, oh, we've seen evidence of fraud on your account. You say, yeah, I'm trying to deal with it. Call this number. And you call the number in the email, and of course you don't get through to the real deal. So you do need to do your research, and you do need to know at least what information you might need to provide and what, say, your bank might ask you, so that you can avoid being rumbled by what is essentially a follow-up scam, and so that you've got the information you need, say, to get your account back, rather than, like Mark, you mentioned, you know, the problem with a SIM swap is that when you've been SIM swapped, you look like the bad guy because you're trying to get your own number back. You look like a SIM swapper, which you are, but you're trying to get it back legitimately. Mm-hmm. Do you have all the evidence that you would need to convince the other end that you're the real deal and the other guy is the crook?
Yeah, because I think that was just stopped in time, because it was, I think the bad guy was obviously just about to start mining his Amazon account and everything else, but he made that step and literally turned up at the store and as he was told to, and then it gets sorted out. But it was hellish for about a week, and I'm sure he's not recovered yet. Yeah, difficult stuff.
That's good advice there from Duck about having your bank details to hand, because whilst I haven't been a victim of an online scam, I did have a bank card cloned once.
All right.
Yeah, it was quite funny. It showed that I took some money out the hole in the wall in Hornchurch, and then 2 minutes later, another ATM in Tottenham Court Road.
Ooh, that was fast moving. Yeah, I heard something similar, which was, there's a cash machine I used on holiday, which was literally a bloke sitting at a desk saying, write down your details here. And we really needed some money. So I was like, well, there's nothing else I could do. So as I walked away, I thought, that's going to get cloned. And of course it did. Yeah. But it was obvious because it was cloned soon after. It wasn't cloned straight away, weirdly enough. Maybe they sold it on, but cloned soon after. And I was in Leeds at the time or something like that. And then it was also being used in Turkey. I was like, pretty sure I'm not there.
Lee, for the benefit of our overseas listeners, am I right that Hornchurch is by the sea, whereas Tottenham Court Road is in London, which is not?
Yes.
Hornchurch is in the depths of Essex. And I think if you would go by car or train, you're looking at least an hour and a half away.
Yeah.
Oh, when you said train, I thought you were going to say a day and a half.
It took a while.
Yeah. That 2 minutes, that would be pretty good.
Yeah.
Light could do it, but sound could not.
Can see you, but we can't hear you. Excellent. Yeah. So, if we're closing, then final advice: be prepared, I suppose, because it seems to be one of those things like people saying, "Oh, I'll always back it up," and then they never do until they have to because they've lost something. So, is it
the only backup you will ever regret is the one you did not make?
It's true. So, it's all about being prepared. Alice, are you prepared? Are you ready for anything?
I mean, I'm a creative and I come from a completely different background.
Is that an excuse?
No. And I think it's an education for me because I love cybersecurity. I'm really passionate about it and I'm really passionate about the human side of cybersecurity. But I think it depends on what words you're using. So when you're saying backups and breaches, to my brain, if I hadn't been in this industry, I'm yawning and thinking, it's like talking about procedures and logistics. To me, it's just dull. Whereas if you're talking about data privacy and your private messages and, you know, your company data being unable to be accessed when you need it, that sort of stuff speaks to people. So I think talking in the language that's relevant to your audience. So when you are giving training, you're talking in examples that they can relate to. Like if you talked about a fire drill and, you know, making sure you know where your fire exits are. But if you're talking about it in a way that's much more relatable, that's when people actually think, yeah, I do need to know about this. And I think personal data is a really strong example of that.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually. Yeah, security doesn't often sell it very well, does it?
Sometimes. Indeed. And that's, by the way, why when you do a fire drill, you actually go out through the fire escape and you actually go down the stairs and you actually
I had to do one yesterday, but it was a beautiful day yesterday, thankfully. So.
Yeah.
Of all the days to have to stand outside. That was a good one.
It was a good one. Out.
It's raining everywhere here. Yeah. So are we all prepared? I don't know. I'm not sure I am. But I don't know. Lee, are you prepared? Are you ready?
As prepared as I'm going to be. But that's probably because I work in this industry.
That's very true. That's true, yeah.
There's an awful lot of other people who could take, especially the advice Duck gave earlier. But to add to that, I would say don't be too scared of automation and AI. It can do the heavy lifting, but that sort of human curation is still important.
Indeed, the human element is very important. Paul, looks like you're right to say.
Yes, I was just going to reinforce what Lee was saying. And if you're looking for a security provider or a security advisor or someone to do training for you, please try and favor someone who values the human element and who doesn't just try and automate everything and say, hey, we've got a cloud bot that can do it. Because that human centricity really, really helps. Like I said, that's why in a fire drill, real humans go through a real door and go down a real staircase into a real car park, because that's what matters, actually doing it for yourself and experiencing it with other people. It's much easier than just reading about it or online or just seeing what the AI bot thinks might work for most people. You don't want most people's fix when you're in trouble. You want something that actually is geared to and will work for you.
Also, I would say if you're going to spend thousands of pounds on cybersecurity, give yourself a base level of knowledge, because lots of cybersecurity people sadly do try and bamboozle so that you have to spend more and you don't understand what you're buying. And so, you know, if you are going to go down this route for your business, which you should do, then make sure you're educated and you're making informed decisions and not buying stuff that you actually have no purpose of. You know, it's like buying insurance that isn't actually usable in practice.
Okay, so I'm going to sum this up in a very journalistic way by saying our advice is be prepared, be cynical, and be safe. Thank you. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Lee. Thanks to Alice. Thanks to Paul. Tell your friends, tell your colleagues. You can now find ISF Podcasts on all major podcast platforms. Look for our page on Audioboom, where you can subscribe to make sure you don't miss an episode, and who would want to do that? The podcasts are also available at securityforum.org, where you can also learn much more about ISF research, tools, and guidance.